Hello. NapoleonicQuarterly@gmail.com is the place to send your questions. Whether you're one of those listeners who like to catch up as soon as the episodes drop and you're there listening in the first week or so, or whether it's many years from now. And, you know, we're still going, but you've got a lot of catching up to do. But that's okay, because regardless of how much progress you've made, you can drop us a line at any time and we'll pick up your question and put it to some of our historian expert types, two of which are with me today, two very familiar voices, our main panelists, Charles Esdale and Alexander Mika Baridze, both joining us for this, the second Napoleonic Qs, as we're calling this bonus episode, not as in queuing to cross the Beresina or something, or queuing for bread in Paris or something like that. That's an English joke, which American listeners won't get. But, well, maybe they will. But, in fact, the question and answer kind. So, as always, Alex, hello to you.
Hi. Greetings from Georgia, but the real one, the one and only one. I'm in the capital city of Tbilisi. I've been crisscrossing the country in preparation for my kind of new research project, actually visiting all those places that we'll hopefully be talking when we get to that global dimension of Napoleonic Wars.
That's absolutely brilliant. It does seem like you've been having some pretty impressive adventures, you know, up into the mountains, crossing flooded areas. It sounds all highly dramatic. But very good to have you. And of course, you're ahead of us in time zone times as opposed to behind Charles and I, which makes for a change as well. And Charles, how's the Isle of Man been treating you?
Oh, mother am I, fear thy. Very good. Very good. Yindersak, even, which means wonderful. It is a very, very good place to live. And I am sitting here in the kitchen of the house that we have finally moved into after many travails. I won't give you a tour of inspection because it's a bit of a mess at the moment, but we are getting there. And I even have a table I can sit and work at. This is an advance over the past few weeks.
This is real progress. That sounds good. So, very good. Okay, well, look, let's dive straight in. And there's a few questions here. I've got just six or seven questions or so picked up from Facebook comments and from Twitter as well, and I think possibly one or two from somewhere else. But I wanted to start with the very first question, or rather, you know, or comment that landed in the inbox. You can imagine my excitement at having invited listeners to send in their questions and comments, and this was a really exciting moment when I got my first email to the NapoleonicQuarterly@gmail.com inbox. There I was, clicking on it, and you can imagine my feelings as I read the following. It's from Dave Robertson, by the way, a chap called Dave Robertson. Dave Robertson writes, "Why do you have that Charles on the podcast? He is such a Napoleon hater. His opinions are worthless, as they are so heavily biased with English historical Napoleon detestation. F*** him off."
I'm sorry, Charles.
Okay, it's too...
To be honest, I'm rather proud of that response. I mean, I'm obviously doing something right. You know, I'm hurting them. I'm currently on an exchange, having an exchange on Twitter with a Napoleon fan, and I quote, I mean, you know, it's all good comedy stuff. It really is. This is from a chap called Sean Witten. Quote unquote, I'm not surprised that a professor in Napoleonic Spain would get a distorted view of events, but maybe if you would open your vision to a greater view, you'd realize that you're underestimating the Code Napoleon's effectiveness. You know, I mean, Cult Napoleon is a very strange place. What can you say? There are these people out there who deeply admire Napoleon, who are fans of Napoleon, and if you say anything that you don't like, that they don't like, they lash out. It's interesting that in a later comment, Mr. Robertson says that whenever I come on, he goes off to the toilet.
Ah, well. Let me read this, because so what happened was, and first of all, I should just say that obviously Alex and I are laughing because it's so beyond the pale in terms of unacceptable abuse, that you know, it's just sort of off the charts, and it's you know, pretty severely unacceptable in you know, all general terms. We've got two professors here, and of course there are all sorts of historians who come on the podcast. This has got me thinking, actually, about what's so good about the Napoleonic Quarterly is that the people who in the 21st century are closest to the period are the ones who are basically spending large chunks of their lives almost living in the past. You know, they're spending all their time understanding what's in, you know, inhabiting that period, if that makes sense. And our professors, that's what they do. And so for us punters who are interested in the period and want to understand more about what it was really like, that it's getting to talk to people like you, Charles, and you, Alex, that's how we get to do it. That's the appeal, I think, of the Napoleonic Quarterly for lots of the listeners who I've spoken to. So, you know, I'm quite keen on professors in general. That's my position. Anyway, let me turn to the second email. Oh, Alex, yeah.
Well, let me add something instead. Setting aside, you know, professorship expertise and all, I think it's just a civil discourse that no matter what, we need to maintain. And there might be moments when we disagree. There might be moments when I drive Charles nuts, and sometimes he does, right? Listeners, but in all circumstances, we need to maintain a civil discourse. Disagreements are welcome. Exchange of ideas, argumentation, dispute, this is what we're all about. But done in a certain way that doesn't cross the border, kind of the boundary, the line into the personal abuse and you know, name calling. So there are so many other ways that we can debate each other without kind of using the cussing.
Yeah, I mean, thank you, Alex. I mean, as you'll have seen from my Twitter account, I personally never ever use bad language on at all, ever. And I also strongly discourage people from doing so. I mean, to the extent I've actually really reproved certain people and said, you know, if you want to talk to me, then you'll talk to me in exactly the same way as you would as if you were in my office. That I think is absolutely vital, and people who cannot engage in civil conversation have no right to engage. And I think that we should make it very clear. I mean, I think it was important to have this discussion, but I think that we should make it very clear that in future, anyone who writes in those sorts of terms will be ignored. You know, they have no right to take part in civil debate. Moving on to my own position, I think I ought to say something about my position here. I'm often accused of being anti-Napoleon because I am British. That's something I resent enormously. Being British has absolutely nothing to do with it. And in fact, you know, those of you who know my work, people who know my work, will recognize that in many ways I am a very, very un-British historian. My view of Spain, for example, my view of the Peninsula War, has actually upset a great many people in this country, because I do pay far more attention to the Spaniards than most British historians do, and I do, point out that there is a massive problem with regard to, for example, the behaviour of the British Army. And some of the things which Wellington does, or indeed Sir John Moore does. I mean, yes, we know it makes perfect sense to retreat to La Coruña. We know it makes perfect sense to retreat after the Battle of Talavera. We know it makes perfect sense not to go to the aid of Ciudad Rodrigo. We know all of these things. But in Spain, in 1808, 1809, 1810, all they could see was the British army disappearing into the distance and not doing anything to help. There are massive problems there. And so I deeply resent the implication that somehow, because I am British, it's poisoned my view of Napoleon. My view of Napoleon is very, very hostile. Yes, certainly. But it's a view which is based on many, many years of research in many different archives. It's a view which is based on my appreciation, or perhaps lack of appreciation, of the impact of Napoleon on the common people of Europe, the suffering that was endured across the continent from one end to the other in the Napoleonic age was horrific. Napoleonic reform, I know that in some ways you can say it's modernizing, it's moving the march of history forward and so forth. But the reality was higher taxes, conscription, and greater policing of society. I mean, for common people living in cities like, for example, Madrid, or Seville, they found their everyday lives massively impacted. And I don't just mean in terms of food, and I mean they often were short of food, and indeed sometimes subject to famine. It's things like the way in which taverns, the places of entertainment, the only places that people had, were policed and subject to constant raids and inspection and so forth. Napoleonic Europe was a very, very nasty place. And in terms of the social reforms which are achieved, even those can be exaggerated. I mean, yeah, feudalism is abolished, but what that generally means is that feudal dues are just converted into rents. It certainly doesn't mean that the peasants and day laborers and the like get the land. I have lived the Peninsula War. I have literally tramped the peninsula from one end to the other. I've been into little villages where in many ways things, it still looks like the Napoleonic period, if you see what I mean. So yes, I'm very, very close to this popular experience. But in the end, the thing that gets me with regards to Napoleonic age is not Napoleon. Napoleon was a warlord. He was one more warlord in a line of many warlords. He was very, very good at being a lord. He was very, very good at creating a governmental machine. He was very, very good at energizing his army. I mean, his relationship with his soldiers was extraordinary. But he was a warlord. If he was just accepted as a warlord, I would have little issues with him. I mean, I don't have strong feelings about Frederick the Great or Gustavus Adolphus or Genghis Khan or Julius Caesar or Alexander the Great. They are historical figures which one can discuss. The problem with Napoleon is that you are up against the cult of Napoleon. Napoleon's propaganda machine was extraordinarily clever. It was probably his greatest creation, actually. And it continues to work out, it continues to function to this day, in that, you know, originally you have, you know, Napoleon's, you know, view of his rule and version of events and so forth, and that is simply trotted out by his supporters, and then it's trotted out over the years until it comes down to people like Mr. Robertson, who are clearly believe that Napoleon is some sort of victim, and at the same time some sort of hero. So my antipathy is directed not so much at Napoleon. It's directed at the cult of Napoleon. It's directed at people who propagate the myth, who perpetuate the myth. And I seriously believe that it is the duty of a historian, no matter what period that they are working in, it is the duty of a historian to attack historical myth, to criticize historical myth, to work for the advancement of historical understanding. And I know that there are many people out there who want history to be a series of comforting bedtime stories. They want things that they're familiar with. They want things that they're enjoying. But I'm sorry, I'm not in that business. I try and tell history the way it is. And I might be wrong sometimes. And I might go over the top sometimes. But I honestly think, quite genuinely, that I have done my duty. And I will continue to do so.
Well said.
Well said indeed. Thank you for that, Charles. There you go, Dave. There's your answer. I've had a comment, a thought that's popped into my head during that. But Alex, would you like to say something as well first?
No.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I've had a thought that's popped into my head as you've been speaking, Charles. I absolutely agree with everything that you've said there. Let's just look at this from the editorial point of view. Because this is not a podcast debating the merits or demerits of one man in the period or whatever. It's examining the 1792 to 1815 period, taking it 3 months at a time and using that premise to try to examine in general, you know, what is going on here that is causing this continuous propagation of conflict and there is a little bit of drama in there, which makes it just an astonishing 24 years of history that we're looking at here. It makes sense to have, actually my original idea was to have one panelist who would sum up at the end of each episode and change that panelist each season. But what's been, it's worked out incredibly well because we have not one but two extremely distinguished professors who do have slightly different perspectives on the period as is reflected in their published work, but also as we've heard in how they're discussing. And you know, there is so much to talk about, to pick over between them, so it's, you know, possible that either Charles or Alex may have to step back at some stage in this period, you know, in this project, and there's sort of no pressure on my part if either of them wanted to take a break. But I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we've got a good thing going, and we'll keep. I hope we'll make it all the way through. So, fingers crossed. So, thank you, Charles, for talking that through. You know, this is why we're doing it, basically. I just gently make the point that editorially, a bit of grist to the mill is definitely a good thing. Now, we're not finished with Dave Robertson just yet, because I thought I would, in fact, I was taking the approach that Charles set out, that, you know, that sort of abusive approach is not going to get any traction. And so I sort of, you know, put it to one side and ignored it. But something, on a whim perhaps, I decided to just drop Dave a little line and say, by the way, are you still listening to the podcast? Do you still stand by those views? I wasn't expecting a reply, but I got one. And Dave wrote the following. Alex, I just reread my original email and the language is quite tasty! Apologies for that. Yes, I am still listening. Due to the strengths of your other guests and the other regular from Georgia, when the hater starts talking, it reminds that I need to go to the toilet or put the kettle on. And I admit I'd initially misread that. That final bit about the hater starting talking, I thought he was talking about himself and was being sort of quite, you know, mindful and realizing that, you know, maybe that anger was bubbling up and he has to go off and sort of calm down. I think actually, having read it again, I think he's still being mean, so this is a bit unfortunate. There is a further email that came through from him. And again, I think it's not something that we can act on anytime soon, but he's come up with a specific proposal. So in the context of us all feeling pretty bruised by this whole situation, Dave has a genuine comment. He writes, I think that it's passing curious that a man who would dominate states and continents, shoot people who disobey him, send tens of thousands of men into battle in the blink of an eye, would, judging by his letters, carry on like a lovesick 14-year-old in his love life. What was he like in the sack? Did he dominate his sexual partners? Did he have particular proclivities? I believe that he shared a woman with Wellington. What was her report? How did Bonaparte expect his soldiers to treat local women as they advanced around Europe? What was the sexual climate of the times? Josephine seems to take lovers whenever she felt like it. Was that Norman for well-off married women of the time? Was it expected or frowned upon? What were the sexual boundaries and expectations of single men and women? Was the general population titillated by the sex lives of well-known people? How did they find out about them? Anyway, I'll leave all that with you, but it must at least be worth a discussion. again, we're going to have to take that to the back of the queue because of the swearing, Dave. But it's not the worst idea in the world if set out in a rather idiosyncratic way.
There's actually a lot of interesting stuff that one can get into there.
Because you've written about this a little bit, Charles. Your book on women in the Peninsula.
Yeah, I wrote a book about women in the Peninsular War, which obviously it looks at the experience of women. It looks at the experience of camp followers in the British and French armies, and to a lesser extent the Spanish army. But it's about the women who came to the war on the one hand, and it's about the women to whom the war came. And it's actually mostly about the women of Spain and Portugal. And in Spain, of late, there's been a tendency amongst female historians, women historians, to say that women were active participants in the struggle and that they were political creatures and that they were engaged and so forth. There's very little evidence of that. Most of what you get is about women surviving or trying to survive, but also using the war to effect a change in their own lives. Hundreds and hundreds of Spanish and Portuguese women run off with foreign soldiers, and they do that partly because, you know, that's a way they can get food, but also very, very clearly because in many, many instances they're escaping absolutely intolerable situations. I mean, the conditions of Spanish and Portuguese women were horrible, basically. And the lower you went down the social scale, the worse it got. So there's interesting stuff there. And with regard to the French army, there's a splendid chap called Michael Hughes, who's written basically a really, really good book, which deals It's about the motivation of the French army. One of the things it highlights is sexuality, and how, you know, French soldiers were kind of expected to chase women, and, you know, it was regarded as the norm, and it was regarded as, you know, as how you showed that you were a man. And to be fair, there were officers in the British Army who come over in much the same way. There's a character called Augustus Schaumann, who is a commissary in Wellington's army, and essentially, you know, he can't be in the same room as a woman without raping her. As far as I can see, it's difficult to read the language clearly. The trouble is that making love to a woman, quote unquote, could mean different things in Georgian England. You know, it could just mean flirting. It could mean, or it could mean a lot more than that. But Schaumann is, you know, a massive womanizer, and he leaves a detailed record of it. So there's lots of interesting stuff to discuss. And I think that there's less mileage in discussing sort of the titillating stuff about the sex lives of great men or the sex lives of great women. I mean, as people didn't know about them.
I agree, Charles. And I actually wanted to mention Michael's book as well. I had the chance to meet him at conferences and really enjoyed reading it. And for the listeners, if you're interested, the title of the book is Forging Napoleon's Grande Armée, Motivation, Military Culture, and Masculinity in the French Army. And on the subject, you know, kind of, I completely agree with you, Charles, that the sexual life of Napoleon is really of little interest to me. But what is of interest is kind of the approaches or the treatments of, or handling of sexual crimes in the French or Russian or Austrian or British army. In Russian and French army, rape was a crime. For example, Napoleon's military penal code of 1803 actually has provisions targeting those soldiers who commit sexual crimes. And there are different categories. Soldiers, for example, who commit rape can be sentenced up to 8 years in prison, and those who rape young girls under the age of 14 sentenced to prison sentences as long as 12 years. And in fact, rapes that result in the death of the victim are liable to be punished with execution. So the system, the legal system, is there. The problem, of course, as in any army, is how that system is implemented and enforced. And even though we have, having just spent weeks in the French archives, we have orders of the day from the French units and on the army announcing the names of rapists and the verdicts, they are not, of course, prevalent. That there are, these announcements are quite few in between, which suggests that, of course, at time of war, whether it's a British or French or Russian army, the superior officers would oftentimes close eye on sexual deviancy, on public disorder, on rape, and yes, murder as well.
It's very interesting to hear that, because, you know, that is what's important, and I think is really overshadowed by the little sort of tidbits that you get about, you know, in sort of les liaisons dangereuses mode and all that. You know, just look at the trailer for the new Napoleon movie, and it's all about Josephine whispering things, and, you know, that's what's interesting. So there's always been, you know, Adolf Hitler springs to mind as somebody whose, you know, sexual proclivities has occasionally been the subject of speculation. So I think it's sort of a spin-off of that this perhaps this question's coming from. I mean, there is something about understanding Nelson, for example, in the 1790s. I'm pretty sure he had a lover or two when he was providing naval support in off the coast in 96 or thereabouts, I think. And in general, and he's got his own love triangle that is of fascination to people. But this feels more like it's more like entertainment rather than being important. You know, it's interesting to understand because what were the rules of the game? I think is what I think people listeners would be interested in general, and then you then have the extra layer put on top of that of the court politics and everything with Maria Therese, etc., you know, and or Marie Walewska and Poland. So then the sort of sex as a political weapon. So that there are some other elements to this which might be worth looking at one day, but I think in general we will be covering them as we go along.
But just as a maybe last comment, unless Charles wants to chime in, the post-terror, right, post-Thermidorian kind of period is quite well known to be a period of relaxed sexual mores. And I think the comment that our listener made about Josephine seemingly taking lovers, she took lovers exactly during this period, right? When her relationship with Napoleon is just starting and she doesn't really feel particular loyalty to him or connection to him. And so I think she felt free enough to pursue liaisons with other men. And of course, during empire itself, sexual norms, especially in France, were quite relaxed. I'm here on this trip. I'm actually reading a biography of Stendhal, and I encourage listeners to read the biography of Stendhal or read his journals, and you'll see that this young man, he's in his 20s, right, is as probably most young men are preoccupied with sex, and he's just eager to find, and he does find many partners. And what I find particularly interesting is that when he goes to Germany in the second half of Napoleonic Wars, he's shocked by what he perceives to be a sexual kind of austerity of the Germans, where the sexual proclivities are not as widespread. And I find it particularly kind of interesting in terms of cultural differences between what was the norm in France and what was the norm in the German-speaking regions.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay, time to put that question to one side and move on.
You were going to say, time to put that question to bed, weren't you?
I should have just said it. It's time to put that question to bed. Move on to the next one. Okay, so here's a question, or a couple of questions actually, from Alan Salazar. The first one is, given that the executive function of government during the terror, executive in quote marks there, given that the executive function of government during the terror, i.e. Committee of Public Safety, followed by the multi-man directory, survived as long as they did, Alan wants to know, was it somewhat inevitable that executive by committee was doomed to dysfunction and replaced by a strong man like Napoleon? And then as a follow-up, was there no real possibility, he says, of a George Washington-like scenario with a term-limited president? Was it even considered by revolutionary framers? Now, these questions I put to David Andress, who's returning to the podcast to talk about Brumaire with us. So let's listen to what he has to say.
I think it's a very relevant question. One of the problems that the revolutionaries have got is they lack any structure of useful partisanship. You know, this is something that English politics has started to develop in the late 18th century. Edmund Burke, for example, it can be found at times lamenting that party spirit in England is not strong enough yet, that if people really understood what it meant to commit to a political project, to being members of a political party, they could do so much more. And of course, that more overt sense of partisan identification is going to come to pass in Britain over the decades ahead. But it's absolutely absent in France, which brings with it the great difficulty that there are not leaders that you can commit to following without being accused of factionalism, without being accused in some senses of conspiracy. And you see that if you look back to the end of the Terror, the idea that anyone might be a leader in those circumstances was enough to eventually have them accused of being a traitor. And this is, of course, what they do to Robespierre. They accuse him of being a traitor, of being a secret monarchist, of wanting to make himself king, quite literally. Because they haven't developed the political mechanisms of stable, collective, partisan ambition. You know, that having party policies and wanting to get something done, they just haven't got it. So everything is blurred and subject to suspicion, you know, and cutting through that comes the idea of single person rule, of monarchy. They know how that works. They've done it for centuries and it does work. It's just it takes a little bit of a while for Napoleon Bonaparte to literally become a monarch. But he will do that and that will work because they haven't figured out how to make anything else work.
Yeah, you've talked about political mechanisms there, and I suppose you haven't got established democratic institutions that are you know, that there isn't a culture or established practice of doing these things in a certain way that, you know, in the 21st century now, certainly in the UK and the United States, you have long established democratic institutions that provide a level of defence against, you know, individuals, fingers crossed, thinking of the US in particular, but so hopefully that'll work out. But and not be, hopefully that statement won't be proved untrue in the coming months and years. But they were pretty new at this in the 1790s.
Well, I think this is exactly what one of the big issues that people could reflect on more about the French Revolution is that these are people who come from their own past. They are 18th century people. They've grown up under an absolute monarchy which has been at war with reactionary aristocratic factions for their entire lifetimes. They don't know what 19th century liberalism is going to look like. So they have no conception of how a political assembly could function with 2, 3, 4 major factions in it without those factions trying to destroy each other. They don't know it's possible because it's never been done in their political context. It sort of happens in the English House of Commons, but they regard the English House of Commons as a sink of corruption, you know, fundamentally abusive instrument of royal power. Not a good thing at all. They can see something is going on in America, but America is a long way away, and they imagine it to be a completely different context. So they really, really struggle to see how, you know, the sort of fences and gates that a constitution puts up don't get constantly knocked down by political competition. They don't know how to do peaceful political competition within the framework of a constitution. They think of a constitution as defending the nation from betrayal. So they're constantly looking out for where that betrayal is going to come from, rather than trying to work within the rules they've set up.
And can I ask you, David, about your because this is linked to your work on trust during the revolution. It's all of a piece, really, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, there's so many aspects in which, you know, we see the Terror as a slide into complete distrust, suspicion, denunciation and so on. It's interesting to try and think about what sets that up. Why is that possible? One of the things I've been looking at recently is how in the early years of the revolution under the First National Assembly, how they imagine the constitutional structures. There's going to be elections. Everything's going to be elected from village councils up to the national legislature. It's all going to be elected. But they don't imagine election as a process of choice. They imagine election as a process which will simply deliver up the best people to do what are essentially politically neutral things.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. All the levels of local administration, from the village to the department, they're not understood as political. The legislation that brings them into existence describes them as being administrative, and they are actually literally under the authority of the king. They're not supposed to do anything that they haven't been told to do from above. And what, of course, this process actually unleashes is an absolute hurricane of local political autonomy. Tens of thousands of communities, hundreds of thousands of people trying to do what they want. And they're immediately at odds with the structure of the system. The structure of the system gives them no space to do that. They are in breach of trust. As soon as they try to do something they haven't been told to do. But they think they need to do something. They think they have won freedom in the revolution, and they want to act on that freedom. But they are untrusted from above. The national system does not trust people at the local level to do anything. And that lack of trust is then going to run through everything that happens in the years ahead.
Okay, thanks very much for David to his answer to that question. Now let's throw another one the way of Charles and Alex. And I want to, Charles, you mentioned earlier that being British for you is an irrelevance, but it's not the case for some of our listeners, certainly not for Jacob from Somerset is how I'll call him. So Jacob has a question. His question is, would we have done it without Pitt? And how fundamental was Pitt to success?
Well, in one sense, he can't have been fundamental because he dies and Britain goes on to victory. That said, could Britain have hung on through the 1790s without him? Probably not. I mean, I can't really think of anybody of the same stature, the same perspicacity, the same political skill who could have taken his place. I mean, maybe a British specialist, and you know, and I have to say it, I'm not a British specialist. Maybe a British specialist would disagree with me. I'm not certain. Clearly, I mean, the man is massively important, and I'm not going to disagree with that.
Yeah, I would agree with Charles, and not only in a sense of just personal kind of talents and character traits that Pitt had, but also kind of Pitt's legacy to me is more important if measured through administrative efficiency, executive expertise that he leaves behind. Whether you like him or not as a character, and there is a lot of things you may find unpalatable about Pitt, the government, I think, became more professional while he was at the helm of it. He left behind a working administration. Yes, he did not dismantle the patronage system, but I think, like Napoleon, he tried at least to identify people who were promoted based on merit. And in doing so, I think we cannot, I don't think we would have had Peel or Gladstone or other kind of political figures that come in his wake without Pitt kind of paving the way for them. So I measure his legacy in that sense as well.
Yeah, that's very interesting comments. And but it wasn't total war, and we mustn't get dragged into a discussion about whether Britain was in a total war. But that commitment that was shown in financial terms, you know, it took a long time for the like Lend-Lease, you know, took decades and decades for it to be paid off. But that level of commitment there that was bound up in that person, could you argue that, okay, he died in 1805, but it was that approach that it was sort of set up by him. It didn't work out with Addington. He was brought back, and the commitment did survive, as it were, to push this, to see this through until the end. Okay, he died, but it was that mindset that Pitt had, which did endure until 1815.
He also comes up with the what became the basis of the Versailles settlement. He basically argued that the Allies had to be fighting not for just a return to the Ancien Régime, not the return to the frontiers of 1789. He said there had to be a security belt to contain France. And he believed that there should be a strong United Netherlands, a strong Piedmont, and possibly a strong Bavaria. I can't quite remember. But essentially, there would be like buffer states that would hold the French in and be backed up by Austria and Prussia and so forth. And that actually does go on to be part of the basis of the Vienna settlement. I'm not saying that Pitt could claim the credit for the Vienna settlement, but certainly his ideas are in a sense going in the right direction.
Yeah, and I think his management of the war, I think, can be criticized on many occasions, maybe for its overly kind of optimistic views in terms of strategy, or sometimes kind of tactical dispositions of the campaigns that Britain attempted. But overall, I think what I find particularly interesting with the view Pitt is that on two darkest years of this period for Britain, 1797 and maybe 1805, right, before Trafalgar, right? Britain kind of endured the test, and in those periods, Pitt was in command. So I think there are some things that I find questionable in terms of his vision for international system, or that I think Charles alluded to. I think he was overly optimistic for that moment in time. But overall, right, his views, general views, I think, came to fruition in the end.
Good stuff. Thank you. Now, let's have a question from one of our Facebook page followers. This is Kyriakos Kougianos, who has been in touch a few times. He's listened to a few episodes since we came back, and he says he's very glad the podcast is back on four, which is great. Now, he says, I'm notoriously bad at finding questions when they're asked to me, but here goes. These last episodes, he's talking about 1798, we've focused on the Mediterranean and Italy, but what's going on in Germany and on the Rhine? And this is one that I put to David Hollins, who had one or two things to say, give us an update about how all things were quiet, but at the same time, stuff was definitely going on as well.
I mean, the short answer on Germany and the Rhine is not very much. both sides are exhausted, and you have the peace conference at Rastatt, between the French and the various Holy Roman Empire states. So nobody wants to upset things. And the Austrians are starting on implementing their reforms that finish up in the 1798 uniform and the new musket and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. But the main, you have to see it as Alex and Charles were talking about, that the French are still pushing their luck. Yeah. So you have to see Egypt and Ireland in the context of the French down in Switzerland and Italy. Mm. And what you have, just a little bit of background, there are these Italian, they're everything from sort of moderate, sort of liberal, seeking a bit more liberty type people to right sort of fans of Robespierre,
yeah.
Real ardent Jacobins, but they're known as the Patrioti, and the French had been in touch with them right from the start of the wars, and Napoleon had made use of them to stir up trouble, basically ahead of the armies,
yeah,
in particular. And in 1794, there are conspiracies in Piedmont, Genoa and Naples, which the authority, in each case, the authorities found out about them and chased the ringleaders out to Nice, which the French had just taken off Piedmont. And they're then used. Napoleon makes quite a lot of use of these guys. He's rather dismissive of them, but he uses them, as I say, to they're kind of fifth columnists, agents, messengers, all this kind of thing. And they go in and they contact the local patrioti, make a load of trouble, and then use that as a pretext to march in. So as Mary Robinson was saying in 1798 Q1, Joseph Bonaparte, the ambassador in Rome, and General Dufo were stirring up trouble there at the end of 1797. And Dufo got himself killed. That becomes a pretext for Berthier to march in and take it over. The Neapolitans get a bit nervous. It's a sort of domino theory, I suppose you'd call it, if you use a more recent term. And they sign an alliance with Austria in the May. And, of course, Mac gets sent down there. And as Jonathan North discusses in the Q1 and Q4, it all went a bit it all went a bit wrong when the Neapolitans invaded Rome at the end of the year there.
Yes.
But this also, the capture of Rome also got the patrioti in Piedmont all excited, and they started a rebellion in April 1798, and the authorities chased them out into Genoa, which is that by then was the Ligurian Republic, another one of these ones that Napoleon had taken over. And the Ligurian Republic declared war on Piedmont for invading their territory. And of course, the French said, "Oh yes, we'll come along. We'll help you out."
Yeah.
And over the course of the back half of 1798, the French take over Piedmont, and the king leaves and abdicates, and they set up a sort of rather extreme Jacobin government. Poor old Grouchy, who was the military administrator, he had a bit of a time with them. he sent some troops under Serrurier down to Leghorn in Tuscany to evict the Neapolitans from there. So it's all about that. But the main thing is Switzerland, and the French, they do exactly the same thing. They get these, they go out, they get drunk, they dance around the Tree of Liberty and start singing patriotic songs and all this kind of thing. And it became an excuse for the French to march in to Switzerland in January. And in February they abolish the old Swiss Confederation, which is just a confederation of cantons, and they set up the Helvetic Republic as a very centralized state, although the eastern part of Switzerland is still very much under Austrian influence and is rather separate from the rest of Switzerland. And they found, was it four and a half tons of gold and silver coins in Bern, and that actually financed the Egyptian expedition.
Oh, wow. I had no idea about that.
And so it was quite easy to take over sort of the western part of Switzerland, because that's kind of under French influence anyway.
Yeah.
But the middle of Switzerland was fairly independent, and there was a rebellion there. But the French in the summer of 1798, but the French used that as an excuse to get in and clear out these local officials that have been part of the old confederation. And so the French have seized Switzerland as far up as Zurich and the Graubünden, which is the eastern part of Switzerland.
Yeah, so an awful lot going on, in fact. Yeah, that's,
yes,
that's
not
really
not
good.
Sort of not those we think of as conventional warfare, but the French are definitely pushing their luck, really.
Kyriakos, well, thank you for that question, Kyriakos, and hope you like that answer from David. Okay, and then to wrap up.
What I'd say just briefly is I do very much hear the good gentleman's comments It's far too common to see the revolutionary Napoleonic period in terms of what Napoleon did and what Napoleon did next. If you just focus on Napoleon, you certainly don't get a proper understanding of either the wars or the period as a whole. So yes, I mean I do hear what the good gentleman says, and thank him for his comment, his question.
There we go. Well, that's Kyriakos who writes, greetings from Cologne. So thank you for that, Kyriakos, and hope you like that that answer, courtesy of David Hollins. Now, on to another Facebook commenter, and this is Johann Karl Weiss. I think it's Hans Karl Weiss. Well, Hans Karl, thank you for your questions, and he's sent through a couple, actually. Let's pick up the first one. He says it would be a good idea to have a question back to the experts on the massacre at Jaffa. Back to Jaffa, then. It was by no means was paralleled in other kinds of sieges. He writes, those who surrendered and were later butchered by the thrusts of bayonets on the beach believed that they were spared their lives by the promise of French officers. Also, I wonder why old men and children were among those massacred. He writes, neither the highly esteemed Charles Esdale nor Alexander Mikhaburidze did their homework on this highly complex topic. And then he quotes La Jonquiere essay. My French is not entirely brilliant. So it might be that maybe I might ask one of you to translate this bit. It looks like he's quoting an essay that's something to do with La Décision Terrible de Jaffa, but maybe one of you could help me out.
Sure. This is a short passage in which La Jonquiere describes that the assault on Jaffa was followed by scenes of looting, violence, which continued into the next day. And the historian then says that suffering then was endured for 3 weeks, and the resistance of garrison was finally kind of subject to the fury of the troops. And then the last comment is that about 2,000 soldiers had perished in the fight. 3,000 others had laid down in their arms on the promise of safe life made by Napoleon's aide-de-camp Eugene and another officer by the name of Croisier. And then in another bit, La Jonquiere talks about kind of the massacre itself that takes place on the shores of Jaffa, during which, in one of the kind of passage, she says, the quote that I'm translating loosely, but we had been well advised not to spend the gunpowder, so we had the ferocity of daggers and bayonets to kind of kill these prisoners. We found among the victims many children who, when dying, had attached themselves to the bodies of their fathers. And I think that's the allusion that the listener is making to the children. The question, again, the question is, how much time do we want to spend on an isolated incident, as tragic and interesting it might be, in a podcast that deal with the wider reverberations of the event. This subject is indeed, as Johann Karl mentioned, quite complex in terms of motivation on both sides, in terms of decision making that both sides makes. Charles and I have talked about the decisions that the Janissaries and the Mamluks have made, and then the decisions that the French had to make in order to deal with them. But I think in the allotted time span, I think we covered it well enough. The comment says that by no means was paralleled in other kind of sieges. I beg to differ. I think there are quite a few incidents, both in this period and in earlier periods, when similar massacres took place after the surrender. So I urge him to kind of look it up. As for the children, we don't know whether these were the children of the men who fought, because we know that both in the Mamluk and the Janissary system, young children were enrolled, right? They were purchased as slaves or conscripted through the Devshirme system and incorporated in the Janissary. So do we really think that officers, while bayoneting children, would stop and ask them whether the person lying and dying next to them was their father, or whether this was an extrapolation that they made sometime later. So it doesn't reduce the gruesomeness of the scene of young children dying. But I don't think Charles and I kind of offered any effort to reduce the importance or the gravity of the situation.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I'm very, very aware that I talk much too much as it is, and if almost to go into the sort of detail that one could go into, we'd never get anywhere. And so you know, there are times when we do have to allay detail. And you know, we can only encourage our listeners to, if they feel that we've not done enough, if we encourage them to read more for themselves, then we've actually achieved something.
I think there is a wonderful book that actually one of our colleagues, Charles certainly knows him, Philip Dwyer, who is an eminent Napoleonic specialist, written the wonderful biography of Napoleon, but who sadly for us has moved more into the study of violence. He relatively recently he edited a wonderful book titled Theaters of Violence: Massacres, Mass Killings, and Atrocities, where he discusses situations like in Jaffa and the decision making, the rationale that goes into perpetrating a mass killing like that.
Good stuff. Well, thanks both. That is really, the great thing about the Napoleonic Quarterly. We are, it feels like, on some levels, we're going very slowly, but at the same time, we are whistling through at great pace. It's the fact that this goes on for 24 years that will mean we've got a lot of ground to cover, but we can't alight anywhere particularly. That said, if any Patreon, supporters of the podcast, patreon.com/Napoleonic Quarterly, if any of you guys do want to get involved and have a particular topic that you would like to explore in more detail in one of our bonus episodes, then please do get in touch, and I can give you the advice and help you arrange a panel episode so we can have a bit of extra discussion on this or that. Okay, so to finish, I thought I would just, I've pulled together a few little bits of nice words. We started out with a sour taste in the mouth in this episode. Let's finish with something a little bit nicer. Here's some feedback from listeners. From Twitter, Daniel Plantagenet, at Daniel, yes, good handle. He writes, "What I've heard so far is brilliant, extremely professional, well brought together, and extremely fascinating." That's excellent. Thank you, Daniel. Yeah, that's good. Then we've got Greg Mack, who wrote, "I think of the naval panel which Rachel Blackman Rogers did with Andrew Lambert. Just listened to this while on a long journey. Thoroughly insightful. Thank you both." So that's great. Then we've got Rob Coughlin at Land of Rob. Rob is a top supporter of the podcast, and he just listened to Bubbles Vampire. That's Charles McKay on the really good and Napoleon General. Our Napoleon podcast, as well as Napoleonic Quarterly. "My interest in Vimero is totally now Juno orientated," he says. "I'm still totally gobsmacked that Juno rides off in a carriage with the wives of two of his generals lying wounded on the battlefield." Sheesh. So, yeah, plenty to discuss there. Thank you to Christine from the Footnoting History podcast, also commenting on that Juno episode. "Oh," she says, "I'm excited to listen to this. I think Juno is one of the most fascinating people of the era. He's always been on my long list of people to cover one day." It's true that, there are so many interesting characters. I think that's why the Generals and Napoleon podcast is doing such a good job of taking each of those characters and looking at them carefully. That we'll just keep an eye on people like Talleyrand, like Juno, who there are so many many of them. Andrew James, who was our first Patreon supporter and is always very kind to us on Twitter, he was listening to episode 29 on Defiance at Acre. Another excellent episode from the Napoleonic Quarterly. He says, many, many thanks to you all for doing this excellent series, which is really nice. On Apple Podcasts, I think, James McGowan said, fantastic podcast. Thoroughly enjoying the range of perspectives provided on the Revolutionary Wars so far. That's really nice of you. Thank you, James. And actually, that wasn't on Apple, was it? That was, he was recommending it on Facebook, which is brilliant. If anyone else fancies recommending the podcast, that would be marvellous. And just picking up on an old comment from Apple I hadn't read out before, Nick Laver, his review is headed brilliant, and his comment is fantastic podcast on episode 6 and addicted. So that's great. You can keep going, Nick, and there's plenty more to come. So I can see our two professors have smiles on their faces listening to all of that, which is nice. So we're ending with the sun now peeking through the clouds of our of the initial torrent that we started the episode with.
Is that the sun of Austerlitz?
Well, that's the debate, isn't it? Crikey, yikes! But
and as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I actually don't feel bruised. I mean, if I've elicited that sort of reaction, I must be doing something right.
Well, in that case, Dave, if you're listening, I'd like to invite you to give this podcast a 5-star review, and maybe just something about individuals would be good. You could that's always an option.
And I want to thank everyone for sharing their comments, for asking questions. You know, this podcast cannot happen without you, so thank you for chiming in, for listening and following us on this ride. How many hours left, Alex?
Oh my gosh, too many, too many. But we are making progress. We are. It's only 5,000 something now, days until Waterloo. I think it was over 8,000 at the start. So we are making a bit of progress.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to echo Alex. I mean, thank you very much, everybody. Gramayad even, you know, very kind of you all, and we will continue to fight the good fight.
On that note, bye for now. Charles and Alex and I will be back for the next main episode coming up shortly. But until then, thanks very much for listening.